my biggest gripe, and gripe might be selling it short or an overstatement depending on how you look at it, it's that they have so much to be defined within this rule. And I think that's the primary tension of all of this.
Welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Elizabeth Holtrup, and today I am very excited to be joined by Brett Goodnack, who actually works with me on the team here at Compliance Alliance. I'm going to do a brief intro, and then we're going to discuss some of the BSA and AML changes that are coming down the pipeline and get Brett's analysis on that. So Brett Goodnack, JD, CAMS, is Associate General Counsel for Compliance Hub. Brett has over a decade of experience in due diligence and risk mitigation, including holding former roles in trust administration and governance consulting. He previously served as associate director in AML and KYC for a global investment bank. Brett is also a featured author for Compliance Alliance. Brett, welcome, and thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Oh my gosh, thank you, Elizabeth. It's a true pleasure to be here. Is it kosher if I drink coffee periodically throughout the podcast?
Brett, I would be shocked if people think we do our jobs without like running on pure caffeine. So I would be disappointed if you did not.
I just wanted to clear that in the beginning.
So we have had some changes coming down the pipeline with BSA and AML. Specifically, there was a notice of proposed rulemaking that came out, I believe it was earlier this month. I don't think it was even late last month. I think it's still pretty recent.
Yeah.
And this is looking to potentially replace the framework that we had in 2024 that was going to give us some more guidance for BSA and AML programs at banks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about this. You've written on this for Compliance Alliance. There's been some analysis out in our newsletter for members. Any intro words, or do you want me to start kind of going into some of my thoughts and we'll talk this through?
Yeah, no, please. I will need your structure or else I'll be a cat chasing my own tail.
My first thought is one big characteristic we can see in the new proposed rule, it seems to be taking a much more broad, less prescribed tone than the 2024 guidance was taking. But to me, a broad tone does not necessarily mean looser rules at the end of the day. But does it? What is your thought? Can you give us your opinion on whether broad means looser?
Yeah, great question. Analysis or assessment of it. I mean, honestly, if you wanted to paint this NPRM with the broadest stroke possible, I think that's a great encapsulation of what it is, because you alluded to the 2024 proposal. The 2024 proposal definitely had its critics. There's really no secret about that. It had its fans, but even its fans had problems with it. Regardless of what side of the fence you came on the 2024 proposal, you had to admit it was a lot more formalized than what
it is. It was.
This rule is, as you said, far less prescriptive. But less prescriptive doesn't always automatically mean easier, more lax. Sometimes a broad standard can be more forgiving. That's certainly true. Mm-hmm. But other times, the fact of the matter is, it just means it's more subjective. It just means it's more up to human judgment, especially when parameters aren't defined, which is, if I had to nitpick, I do. Oh, this rule, my biggest gripe, and gripe might be selling it short or an overstatement, depending on how you look at it, it's that they have so much to be defined within this rule. And I think that's the primary tension of all of this, because they're clearly trying to with this rule. And this is admirable, noble. I think banks everywhere really want this. Move away from process-heavy AML framework and supervision. And they want what BSA has always been about, a more risk-based, effectiveness oriented framework. The proposal says as much. I mean, it says it in its words.
It says, yeah. Can you talk a little bit, that phrase risk-based, I mean, we use that constantly in compliance, right? The 2024 rules also discuss being risk-based. It's a phrase that tends to come out in a lot of places. how is this risk-based approach different from any other risk-based approach? Or is it kind of using that term as an umbrella catch-all phrase, in which case, what are bankers to make of it?
I mean, a great point. You can sort of patch over a lot of catch-all is a great term for it, because when you don't have guardrails in place for a phrase like risk-based, it kind of loses its teeth. It loses its meaning. They throw these other terms to build volume into what risk-based means. Phrases like effective and reasonably designed in all material respects. These are supposed to give meaning to what risk-based is. And risk-based is supposed to fit, risk-based is supposed to be more subjective because it's supposed to fit the bank's own profile, their size, their complexity. But just because a framework like that is less rigid, it doesn't mean it's more effective. It means it's less pinned down. It means it's harder to define what some of those things are. Objectively mean. That's dangerous sometimes. I wanted to highlight one. I'm talking a little bit in vagaries. I mean, some of the some of the phrases I mentioned are particularly troubling. Those
because they're nebulous, right? I mean, we know what they mean in the dictionary, but how do we apply some of that to a bank's program? I think that's why they're maybe a little bit troubling to some of us, because we're not quite sure how they'd be defined or applied. Is that fair to say?
Right. Okay. Absolutely. And, you know, insofar as admitting they're a work in progress, the NPRM, you know, it has a commentary period. They ask for feedback on what some of these definitions mean, which is good in one regard, but also, again, troubling in another, because if you're at this point where you don't know what these words mean, how did you come to a consensus that this is the rule and that this is what meaningfully going to impact banks? I wanted to highlight one section, one statutory section of the rule at 1020.221D. Okay. Just hang with me for a second, because
I love direct citations. Can you repeat that one?
If you're looking at the PDF of the NPRM itself, it's on page 50, and it is I got too many dang tabs open, it's at 31 CFR 1020.221D, specifically D2.
Okay, in the proposed rule.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
And it tells FinCEN to consider whether a bank, taking into account its size, complexity, and risk profile, has advanced the AML-CFT priorities by providing highly useful information, conducting proactive analytics, or performing innovative activities producing demonstrable outputs. So I wanted to focus on this because I think this is a great example of why broader doesn't always mean more effective, doesn't even necessarily mean looser. A rule can give a few rigid instructions and still expect banks to demonstrate something more ambitious or more useful. And the issue is that highly useful information, proactive analytics, demonstrable outputs sound great, right? Sound appealing, sound sexy, sound like, yes, we can really do something to change the world. We can help our community banks.
Financial crime.
They're not defined. There's really nothing that you... It's up to the bank to a certain degree, so it's looser in the margins, but because of that, it's kind of risky because it's going to turn on judgment calls that don't have any substantive criteria to go off of by the banks, by auditors, by examiners, and maybe by FinCEN. You got to hope FinCEN has something in its back pocket, but I don't know. And take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt, because
of course.
A lot of this is going to sound like I'm a conspiracy theorist, but like this is
I mean, it's the analysis we need to be thinking about, right? Because you and I, we are advisors. We talk to banks that when they're trying to figure out how to apply specific rules to their banks. So something like this, I think it's going to be really, really welcomed by a lot of banks, but it is probably literally our job to think through some of those underlying things, which maybe eventually could become questions for banks. Like, hey, a lot of banks are going to read this and think it sounds like it's potentially a regulatory relief, potentially. But then people like you and, you know, me, we're looking through the rule going, where is the specific relief? Because we want to offer that to our banks. I'm just not quite sure where to nail down the specific relief is coming in. And I think perhaps that's going to have to develop as an industry standard. The trouble is right now, we're not quite sure how that's going to play out.
Totally. Yeah.
One thing I tend to think about is that regulatory relief sometimes can be highly prescribed, right? It'll say things like, here's a small bank exception, or here's a de minimis threshold, you know, all those types of things where banks can wipe their brow, say, phew, we did our due diligence to show that we're under this threshold. We don't have to do this or this or this. BSA does not have a lot of those thresholds because just one financial crime going through your bank is a problem, which we all understand. Nobody necessarily wants a little bit of financial crime at smaller banks. I'm being ironic, but you know what I mean.
You're right.
I still think, though, that there's a little bit of subjectivity in BSA. For example, SAR filing is very, very subjective. I mean, within, you know, those parameters of your aggregate dollar amounts and that type of thing. No one can actually tell you when to file a SAR and when to not, unless the facts are very, very clear. I'm concerned that the proposed rule maybe poses some of those broader subjectivity questions that are going to be a headache for the actual staff trying to implement them. Am I being too critical, or is that a concern that bankers are going to see?
Again, I think that is a really valid concern. I mean, there's some changes that put a lot on the individual mm-hmm. who serves as the BSA officer mm-hmm. who's going to be asked to implement the changes into their BSA AML program at the bank. It puts a lot on one person to establish and implement a program, coordinate day-to-day compliance, do all of this themselves. I don't really know how other to articulate than it's unrealistic at a point. The amount that this rule seems to be expecting one individual to do, what I'm trying to get at is mm-hmm. that. There's this shift that happens within the rule that the bank has to properly establish and implement mm-hmm. in all material aspects. Again, this is something that the NPRM doesn't really define. Mm-hmm. Major supervisory enforcement action based on the program rule wouldn't affect anything other than those significant or systemic failures mm-hmm. To implement the program. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have this individual it's their task to establish and implement the program. Tough enough in itself, but then you're told within this rule that you will be only punished for significant or systemic failures.
Sure.
That likewise isn't defined, but by that phrasing, significant or systemic evokes kind of a catastrophic mm-hmm. failure. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, that's not how you mentioned SAR filings. Mm-hmm. SAR filings are triggered off of relatively low threshold mm-hmm. and meaningfully so. failures happen incrementally. They happen over time. They happen bit by bit. When this rule is telling us that it's only going to be these significant or systemic failures to implement the program, that is troubling because it's another one of these paradox things that I've been seeing a lot in other recent rules. It's asking so much of one individual and by proxy, the BSA department to implement a tremendous amount of responsibility, all these expectations, and then at the same time, not really know how effectively to monitor, what to monitor for, because all you know is at the end of the day, the only thing that's ultimately going to get supervised or enforced is some giant systemic failure. What's going to lead to a systemic failure, you don't know.
Yeah,
you're kind of going off of your own playbook here. Mm-hmm. It's confusing, mm-hmm. to say the least.
Do you think that the role of audits, independent audits, might become more important to banks? Because I'm just talking off the top of my head here.
Yeah.
But if banks really want to check up on how their program is doing before examiners come in, especially if potentially it remains a little bit nebulous as to how examiners are going to start looking at the program under these new frameworks, is it possible that banks may wish to engage audits to help them look at their program and give a reasonable third-party look at how the program is going? And might that role of an independently engaged audit become even more important than it has been in the past as a way to get a checkup and get a second look? Because, like I said, this could be somewhat subjective. I don't want to be, you know, making a mountain out of a molehill, but like you're also saying, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the person or persons administrating the program. Talk to me about your thoughts about third-party audits and how banks might use that as a tool to help mitigate risk.
I do think that it's going to be very important. I think that's a great point, Elizabeth, but I think it comes back to the same problem. I don't know how it's a problem that gets broached either, because you'll have, just take any auditor. Mm-hmm. Some hypothetical where you have one auditor going to two banks.
Yeah.
They go to one bank where they think that they have a well-established program because its mm-hmm. design is rational and tailored mm-hmm. to them. The auditor thinks that it is. The same program for another bank, the auditor thinks that it's underdeveloped or under-supported. And what is the criteria that changes that analysis? Mm-hmm. There's not enough in the rule, at mm-hmm. least in what's there right now,
yep.
to really differentiate.
Okay. Yep.
Outside of that, again, it's admirable that they're trying to get away from check the box kind
yes.
of assessment,
yes.
right? You don't want that because it doesn't effectively do mm-hmm. anything to prevent crime or mm-hmm. money laundering. It doesn't reduce the risk of the bank when you're simply just doing something to do something. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you're in a nebulous area where you don't know where things are too subjective, mm-hmm. then you lose effectiveness that way. So mm-hmm. third-party audits are going to be important. And if you're a third-party auditor, you're probably going to be looking at the same things you've always looked at. I don't know how you're going to be judging them necessarily, but you're still going to be looking at risk assessment processes mm-hmm. That identify whatever that bank's money laundering or terrorist financing risks are, mm-hmm. the controls that they have in place mm-hmm. for those risks, the staffing. Mm-hmm. The resources they have allocated for that resource mm-hmm. allocation is a big thing in mm-hmm. this rule. Escalation, monitoring, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. All, you know, the stuff that auditors still to this mm-hmm. day have been tracking. It's still mm-hmm. going to be important in the mm-hmm. future once this rule, or if this rule is finalized. But now it'll be towards the end of proving that you have a properly established and implemented program. But the rub is just that, there's no like concrete criteria for that necessarily.
Yeah. I totally agree with you that we need some changes. I mean, Patriot Act came out over 20 years ago. I'm old enough to remember when the Patriot Act came out. Some listeners maybe won't be, which shows how this has become established banking practices. Periodic overhauls are necessary, welcome. The question is, to me, what is the driving purpose behind this change? You've talked about how maybe the current framework had become too proscriptive, such that banks are just jumping through hoops for the sake of it. I've harped on the concept that maybe subjectivity is difficult for banks to manage, but I do want to pull myself back a little bit because every bank is subjectively different from every other bank, right? I mean, different management, different ownership, different asset size, and geographic location plays a huge role, as well as what market the bank is penetrating into, whether geographically or online or anything like that. So I really, really do want to be mindful that a subjective approach is probably necessary in a lot of ways. Just then, how do you objectively analyze it to assess whether the program is doing what it needs to do? I'm struggling a little bit getting my head around how you objectively analyze a subjective concept.
I mean, your guess is as good as mine, probably better. You ask why this rule, I mean, this rule has been a long time in the making. They've been trying to overhaul or refine AML rules for a long time now. I mean, it didn't start with the 2024 rule. The 2020 AML Act was probably the last or first major shift in that area. The priorities were the step in that direction too. I think one of the bigger things that the rule is trying to achieve, and again, it's said as much within the rule, is that they want effective outcomes from what's actually being produced from the outputs of banks. So like the reportings that we've talked about, they want to make sure that the processes, the procedures that banks have in place are actually putting out the most useful information that they possibly can for law enforcement that will then prevent crime and money laundering nationwide. That's grounded in not only the reports, but in things like the risk assessment processes when they talk about that. I don't know. Why it's happening right now or why it's happening this way. I don't know.
I do like the emphasis on the outputs, right? Because nobody wants to spend a whole lot of banking resources, salaries, time, headaches, and jumping through hoops if they're not required. And by required, I do think looking at the outputs is a good way to see if something's really necessary, right? If law enforcement is like, we have never received anything valuable from this bank, maybe that's an indication the bank's program has failed, or maybe that's an indication that that bank is squeaky clean, nothing, you know, illicit is going through that bank, and they're sending in reports that are just a waste of time because nothing bad is happening. How do you tell the difference? How do you tell if there's nothing there because there's nothing to find versus there's nothing there because there's a failure in the program?
Right. Well, that's one of the things that I think is kind of a fundamental issue with the rule, with maybe even the intention of the rule, because outcomes and outputs, as you maybe unintentionally or probably intentionally hit on what you just said, are different. And the rule uses them interchangeably almost. A bank can't control outcomes, they can control outputs. What a bank can control is its monitoring, its due diligence, its escalation, but it can't control what law enforcement does with it, whether prosecutors pursue a case, whether a filing turns out to be strategically valuable months later. So when this proposal keeps using outcomes and outputs and uses them kind of flowing interchangeably within the same train of thought, it hasn't really drawn any distinct line between what a bank can actually influence and what it can't.
That's a really good point. Really, really good point. Don't give me credit for brilliance that I don't have, because I was using those terms interchangeably as well. But as soon as you are talking through this, of course, there's a difference between a bank can control its outputs. It cannot control the outcome of whether that's valuable information to law enforcement or whether it actually helps fight crime. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And it's all framed in an outcomes model, but yeah, again, by the use of both terminologies and by the expectations that it appears to be putting on banks, it again just seems to be an unrealistic expectation, unrealistic set of standards that they're imposing upon a bank.
Do we have any hunch that there could be changes to the rule? This is a proposal. It's a significant proposal. Do we think, just based on personal opinion, whether we're going to see significant changes to the final rule, including perhaps more closely defined terminology, closely defined assessment of how outputs and outcomes are going to be analyzed, anything like that? Or is your personal opinion that we might get a framework substantially similar to the proposal in the final rule?
I think that's a great question. I would anticipate some changes, but I don't know how many major changes are going to happen.
Okay.
Because you have to keep in mind that this is an interagency kind of effort. There was a rollout with all of the other agencies. I can't say all the other agencies, but the FDIC, the OCC, and the NCUA also, in short order, put their versions of this rule out. The Fed is still, as of our recording, MIA for theirs, which raises its own practical questions, why there's an asymmetry there. But the fact that there are all these contemporaneous rules, all seeking comment, but you'd expect them to mirror each other. But the fact that they're all out there kind of sets this baseline expectation that they kind of have something in mind. They're probably not going to change that much from what they are now. They are asking a lot in their comments by way of defining key terms, as we've talked about throughout our time together today. And as an optimist, I would hope that those phrases and those key definitions get defined. Whether that happens, I don't know. Whether our prudential regulators actually adopt and mirror and operationalize what changes come via comment, I also don't know. Whether that happens in enough of a time frame for when and if, I guess I should say, the pendulum starts to swing the other way around, I also don't know that too. I mean, the 2024 rule came, this rule came 2 years later, who's to say what's going to happen 2 years down the line? FinCEN has done an about face on a lot in the past 2 years. I can't, about face might be a little bit hyperbolic, but they've made some changes.
Some significant changes, things like the SAR continuing SAR guidance.
Right.
Things like beneficial ownership.
The acceptance relief.
That type of thing that maybe some of us didn't really expect to see coming down the pipeline. And I think the effort is to provide regulatory relief to banks. But there's been a lot of changes. I agree with you.
There have been a lot of changes. So I only mention that to say that while I don't know and suspect that there may not be significant change from the version of this rule that we see today to the finalized version, if it gets finalized, I don't know what changes will come in a couple years from now, when everything might be different. Things might revert back to a bit more of an objective standard. There are a lot of other contemporaneous things going on and considerations going on that are intertwined with the framework being discussed with this NPRM. Things that like BSA filings and the threshold there that depending on if and when this rule gets finalized could impact those. So there's a lot of moving parts and it's tough to predict, but I suspect that the final rule is going to probably look significantly similar to the rule we have today, just hopefully with a little, at least a little bit more defined terminology where it really needs it.
If we suspect that the final rule, if it's approved, may look substantially similar to this, and I personally don't have any reason to have a different opinion on that, let's close up the episode with some advice to bankers. If it were you running a BSA AML program at a bank, would you be looking to take substantial action to change your program in any way? Would you hold the course and see how this plays out? What would be your approach in light of the potential of this being finalized?
Another great question. I would tend to be a little conservative, even just hearkening back to what we talked about a moment ago, because you really don't know what's going to happen a couple of years down the line from now. But even irrespective of that, I wouldn't jump to wholesale changes because of this rule. I just don't think that would be prudent, no matter how you interpret this rule.
Sure.
What I would recommend, as with any proposed rule, especially one that purports to be as significant as this one, would be a gap analysis. You know, compare what you have to what potentially could be changed. I'd focus on a few different things. The first thing would probably be not too crazy of a shift, something your bank's probably already doing. That phrase that we love to say, your risk-based analysis. I would just say, try as best as you can to map your AML program to what your bank's risk profile is. Ideally, you've been doing that. But don't just update whatever your annual risk analysis is, whatever that is, but actually see whether your bank's staffing, policies, procedures, controls, monitoring, escalation, I keep mentioning, are actually lining up with what your real life risks posing your bank are. Because for whatever else you take away from this rule, there's no denying that it puts a lot of weight on the risk assessment process.
And it does.
That through and through.
Yeah.
I also mentioned that it puts a high priority on resource allocation. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, some tension there as well, because it asks a lot and doesn't define as well in that area either.
Yeah.
But resource allocation's a fairly practical step, mm-hmm. albeit probably a nuanced and difficult one. But I think that it's one that is worth taking before FinCEN ever defines it. Mm-hmm. Because the rule talks about allocating resources to higher risk areas, mm-hmm. and it doesn't really, you know, go into excruciating detail, but the bank should decide ahead of time what that means to it.
Okay.
So take all the resources that it has. It's staffing, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. people, it's time, it's technology.
Yeah.
AI is going to be something that we talk about a lot in the years to come. But but all of your other technological tools, mm-hmm. All of your support that you have operationally, mm-hmm. by way of escalation, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. So define those things internally and decide where you're going to focus your resources risk wise. And I think given that they are redefining the BSA officer role to be mm-hmm. an individual rather than individuals, I don't think that's necessarily going to eliminate the ability to have multiple people in that capacity, but I do think that the expectation is going to shift to put a lot on one person, if for no other reason than to make it easier to have a straw man. So what I think a bank should do is to get a person that you really, really trust to be in that position and get them all the tools and resources that they need to do their job as effectively as possible. So just mm-hmm. analyze your BSA officer role mm-hmm. and make sure that they're in the best seat possible.
Yeah.
Just another kind of gap analysis to mm-hmm. what where they're at now and what your risks really are. Are they mm-hmm. equipped to deal with everything? Are there any anticipated mm-hmm. improvements that you could be making there?
I appreciate that. I appreciate the focus that you have highlighted on the fact that the single BSA officer is going to have some responsibility on their shoulders that they've always had, but it's a little bit more delineated in this rule. Risk analysis, gap analysis, and resource allocation. Big ones. I like that trio you've laid out. That's not something you're going to accomplish in an afternoon. It's going to take a while to sit down and really assess the program. But honestly, even without any changes to the rule, those are really, really important things to be doing periodically anyway. So I would say it's all to the good for banks to start, or banks, but specifically the BSA officer, to start implementing some of that, because it's always, always a good checkup to do that type of analysis, even if the proposed rule is substantially changed at a final rule, or perhaps it's never finalized or it changes in the future. Always a good thing to do resource analysis, and so resource allocation based on your risk analysis, your gap analysis. So I appreciate that guidance and advice for you that you've given bankers. Brett, we have taken up a lot of your time. I appreciate your thoughts and insights so much, coming from your background of working directly within banks on this topic, and then the deep analysis that you bring to our team on this topic. Your time here has been so valuable to me, and I really, really appreciate it. Anything else you would like to add to bankers as we wrap up the episode?
I just want to thank you, Elizabeth. Just keep your ears to the ground, banks. Like I said, this change is coming pretty fast and furiously as of late. So, you know, We know that the final rule might be coming in short order, and it might look very similar. There might be some changes, but we also know that there might be more changes beyond that too. So just keep paying attention, and we're here to help too. Don't hesitate to reach out. This is not something that can be ignored. That's the long and short of that.
Stay alert. Reach out if you'd like to talk it through. We're here to help. Thank you so much, Brett Goodnack, for your time. It's been a real pleasure talking to you for the past several minutes. Until next time, this is Elizabeth Holtrup, and this has been your episode of Banking Matters.